Alaskans voted to legalize recreational use of marijuana last fall, and now lawmakers and municipal governments must develop regulations and local rules to implement the sale and use of marijuana products. What are the big issues related to this new industry in the state that need to be resolved? How far along is the rulemaking process for licensing commercial growers and retailers? What are your concerns about legalizing marijuana in Alaska? The business of legal cannabis is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Alaska Department of Education is looking for 3 experienced Alaskan educators to help underperforming schools improve instruction and student performance. These school improvement coaches would work as contractors to the state. Apply by September 15th. Call 907-465-8721 or inquire at the Department of Education for information. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about the state of legal marijuana. From about 1917 until 1933, alcohol was illegal in the United States. The end of Prohibition meant American adults could legally purchase and consume fermented beverages without the fear of prosecution. About the same time the nation was warming up to the idea of legal booze, it was turning a cold shoulder to marijuana, and the use of it was eventually criminalized as a Schedule I drug. For about 6 decades, it remained completely illegal until 1996, when California was the first state to allow medical marijuana use. Today, 23 states have medicinal marijuana laws. Oregon, Alaska, Colorado, Washington State, and the District of Columbia have passed legislation making recreational use legal. So what does this mean? Here to update us on the status of marijuana regulation is Bruce Schulte. Bruce is the chair of the state's Marijuana Control Board. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Also, Zachariah Hughes, KSKA's Anchorage Metro reporter, is with us. Zach reports on the work of the Anchorage Assembly and has been following the city's process as it adopts local rules for marijuana growing and use. Hi, Zach.
Good morning, Lori.
Thanks for being here, even though you have a cold.
Thank you. Yep, I will tough it out.
What a trooper. Also in the studio with us is Jane Stinson. Jane is an Anchorage resident and is hoping to open a retail store. Good morning, Jane.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So Bruce and Zach, if you want to jump in on this question as well, where do the state marijuana regulations stand at this point?
Well, the bottom line is we're on schedule. Under the terms of the ballot measure, the state had until November 24th of this year to come up with regulations for this new industry. And we did hit that deadline by a couple of days. We adopted regulations on November 20th. And the next milestone date is February 24th of 2016. And that's the last date by which the state must begin accepting applications for the various licenses. And so far, we're on schedule to hit that deadline as well.
If you want to join our conversation, if you have concerns or you have ideas about what you'd like to see with the legalization of marijuana in Alaska, give us a call. The number statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. Or in the Anchorage area, you can call 550-8422, 550-8422, or email us talk@alaskapublic.org. What were the major sticking points in coming up with these regulations?
Boy, there was a lot of them. There were so many factors that sort of came together to guide that process. In fact, the board identified at one of our workshops 10 different contributing factors. Of course, there's the ballot measure itself. There's legal precedent. There's federal issues and so forth. I wouldn't say that there was any one issue that we got hung up on. Although, in-state residency for business ownership, that was a very controversial one, or received a lot of discussion. The whole question of marijuana clubs and facilities with on-site consumption, that took up a lot of our time. And then there was a lot of smaller issues that got a little less public attention, but still absorbed a lot of the board's time. But at the end of the day, I'm really pretty happy with where we ended up. It was a very, very short schedule. And honestly, we could spend another 12 months on it. And we probably will refine those regs over the next 12 to 24 months. But I'm pretty happy with where we ended up.
Yeah, I would just say rather than any one sticking point, it was a little bit more like a cactus with a bunch of little needles poking out.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, one big regulatory cactus. But, you know, some of the stuff that Bruce mentioned emerged almost as an afterthought. You know, it didn't become controversial until regulations started to be knitted together. So on-site consumption was one that got some attention, and that's partly because you have people wondering, well, if I buy cannabis in one place, will I be able to consume it there? Or we've had some cannabis operations that are similar to clubs, but in a sort of legal limbo at this point. And so you have, at this point, business owners and effectively a lobby that has a stake in how that question gets solved. So, you know, different sticking points, but no one giant controversy that I think anyone thinks has derailed the process. And I would agree with Bruce that just sitting in different meetings at the state level, the legislative level, the regulatory level, and then local decisions here in Anchorage, it is moving along in a way that I don't see that many you know, government functions that are this diffuse kind of progressing.
Yeah, when you consider government in action, this was probably one of the better examples. I mean, we really, considering the schedule and the scope of what we had to do, pretty much from zero, I think we've come a long way.
Well, we're not there yet, so there's still time. There's a giant botch could still happen in the near future.
That's true. But
if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking today about where the state and local municipalities are in implementing rules and regulations and local ordinances regarding the use and sale and growing of marijuana. How did you deal with the residency requirement? What do people, how long do they have to be a resident in order to either be a grower or a seller? Mm-hmm.
Well, at this point, after our last meeting, it's really straightforward. In order to qualify to be a licensee, you know, to hold one of the various cannabis licenses, one has to meet the same residency requirements as they would for the PFD. So minimum of 1 year in the state, I believe, and, you know, probably a few months thereafter. So if they qualify for the PFD, then that's certainly a check mark in the licensing process. If they just moved to the state in the last month, they're probably not going to qualify. So it's an easy metric, and one of the reasons, actually the main reason we settled on that method of residency was simply that so that staff would have an easy, efficient, and reliable way of determining residency. At one point, we were looking at letting voter registration be the requirement, but it would have ended up requiring staff to go back and do, you know, spend a lot of their time verifying, you know, somebody was registered here, that they're not registered in another state, and even then it's not a perfect system. And it was important that they be able to verify who these licensees are, who the applicants are, in order to meet imperatives defined at the federal level. So that, you know, the Department of Justice in the infamous Cole memo identified a number of criteria which, if met, would basically keep the DEA out of our hair. And one of those was that we had an accurate way of vetting who is participating in this industry. So by having a solid residency requirement and knowing who's applying, that at least one of those criteria.
And what's the rationale behind that? Is it, why have this requirement? What's the Fed looking for, too, in having a requirement about how long someone needs to be in the state?
Well, their requirement is not specifically how long somebody's in the state. Rather, you know, because marijuana is still federally illegal, it's sort of an acknowledgement by the Department of Justice that, you know, states do have rights to come up with their own laws within certain boundaries. And this was a policy memo put out by James Cole in which they said, look, we understand that some states are going this direction, and we will stay out of your hair if we're comfortable that you're not laundering money for organized crime, that you're not involved with, you know, drug cartels, that you're not channeling marijuana to children, all of which, you know, I think everybody can agree are valid goals. So when it came down to residency, it's really more a matter of knowing who's applying, who's participating, knowing that they're not criminals, that they're not part of an organized crime syndicate, that they're not part of a drug cartel. So by knowing that they're an Alaska resident and by having some background checks in place, criminal included, we can have a better assurance that the people who are participating are in fact, you know, Alaska residents that are not, you know, one of these other sort of gray area players.
Sure. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-478-8255. Do you have concerns about the implementation of legal marijuana in the state, or are you hoping to capitalize on a new industry and perhaps open a retail store or become a grower yourself? You can call us at 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255 or locally 550-8422. Bob is on the line from Sitka. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Hey, thank you for taking my call. Down here in Sitka, we, of course, are working on implementation phase of the law, and we have a kind of a couple of issues, and I'm wondering if you could address those. One would be if you could talk a little bit about the rationale about the buffer zones around churches. In a lot of our smaller communities, you can't throw a rock without hitting a church. So that makes it sort of difficult to establish some of the businesses. And secondly, if perhaps we could talk a little bit about testing facilities in small communities, small island communities, I would appreciate your input there.
I'll let Bruce take this.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Those are two really good questions. And in fact, both of those issues I attempted to address in amendments that I introduced to the board on November 20th. The offset distances are sort of derived again from federal precedent. There's a sort of a federal drug-free zone around schools, for example, of 1,000 feet. So that's kind of where it started. The offset differences from distances from churches is not necessarily a federal issue. It's kind of more of a, I don't know, a local social issue, I suppose. There were a lot of communities. Sitka was one. I think Ketchikan and Fairbanks were others that had said, you know, this 500-foot offset is going to make it very difficult for us to meet these requirements. And so I had introduced an amendment that would have reduced that offset to, well, it actually would have removed it entirely for churches. And the rest of the board didn't see it that way, and I was voted down on that. And it's, you know, it's unfortunate, but, you know, it's a struggle because we have such a diverse geography around the state. I mean, if you look at the layout of Anchorage versus Ketchikan, hugely different because of terrain alone. Mm-hmm. And so I would have preferred to take churches off the table there, but you know, like I said, the rest of the board didn't quite agree with me on that. Testing requirement is another really good one, and if I can, I'll summarize it this way: there is a requirement for testing of cannabis products for mold, for residual fertilizer, for pesticides, and for potency. And then these are probably all reasonable things, you know, things that reasonable people would agree should be tested for. The challenge is this: that if you're on the road system, it's a pretty easy thing to meet. We're expecting there'll be at least a few testing facilities somewhere on the road system, maybe Anchorage, maybe Fairbanks, who knows. So those of us who are in business in one of those communities could easily get our products to those testing labs. But if you are in you know, one of the other communities, you know, Sitka, Ketchikan, Bethel, you know, pick your rural mm-hmm. community, you don't have ready access to the testing facilities because of transportation issues.
Right.
Federally, it's problematic to put any sort of cannabis on a commercial flight, even within the state, and that's, you know, something I'd like to see change. But, you know, for now, that's what we're stuck with.
And Bruce, can you just explain why that is? Why water, air, maybe even some rivers are hard?
Yeah. So I'll try and put this in a nutshell. So I'm a commercial pilot, so this hits really close to home for me. So federal aviation regulations specifically say that you cannot carry cannabis in a commercial flight. The crew, the air carrier, cannot carry cannabis in that fashion unless it's legal in that state. So you would think, okay, good, we're solid, right? That's what I thought too. But no, there's a federal statute that overrides that says, okay, all those federal aviation regulations notwithstanding, if a pilot or a carrier knowingly carries these substances, we're going to revoke his license and we're going to pull the carrier certificate.
Yikes.
Yeah, so it's a fairly high bar. And, you know, as a professional pilot, my attitude is, yeah, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to lose my license. But that's the problem that we have right now. So In Oregon, there's sort of this tacit. They basically said we're not going to hold that line for intrastate air transport, which is terrific. Except the Alaska flight standards, people haven't quite adopted that perspective yet.
And what keeps somebody in Bethel who's maybe thinking about a commercial license from also just opening up a testing facility? You know, why not have these be co-licensees in
right.
these areas?
That would certainly be a solution. So and I apologize, Bob, I'll come back to your question here in a moment. So under the current regs, if you own a license for a testing facility, you can't simultaneously own any of the other licenses. Mm. That's the one area in which you can't have stacked licenses. And the rationale was if the fox watching the hen house, sort of. Yeah, exactly. So back to Bob's question. I had introduced an amendment, which actually passed, but which Department of Law isn't very happy with. And basically, I said, look, in the construction industry, there is a precedent whereby if you can submit what's called an alternative means and methods, where you're acknowledging, okay, I understand the regulations, understand the goal, but I have a different way of meeting that goal. So I wanted the door to be open for folks in Sitka and other communities to offer up another way of meeting those testing requirements. Department of Law had some concerns with that. They felt that was too ill-defined, I guess. I'm hoping that stays in there because, testing technology changes. DNA testing, which is something I'm only remotely familiar with through the state's crime lab, that technology has evolved in the last 10 years. It went from requiring a lab setting of, several hundred square feet to a portable unit that can turn out results in a matter of hours. So, we have to acknowledge that testing technology will evolve over time. And, hopefully we'll get some portable equipment or some other solution to that testing problem that folks in Sitka and elsewhere can take advantage of.
Are there setback requirements for liquor stores when it comes to churches?
There are, and I believe it's 200 feet.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the idea of the federal rules that are the laws that are still in place, mm-hmm. and we know that highways have federal funding, the marine highway system has federal funding, mm-hmm. we were just talking about air travel. Are you aware of any kind of movement within the federal government to sort of more officially address the states that have passed these laws and kind of formalize saying, okay, we're going to stay out of any sort of prosecutions if you're driving it around or on the marine highway or flying it? Is there any kind of movement to... I mean, saying we're not going to bother you mm-hmm. is not the same as kind of formalizing, saying here it is written down so that you don't have to have these concerns.
Yeah. But that just opens up such a broad political discussion. At the federal level, there's really three huge challenges we have. Transportation is one. Banking regulations are another. And IRS rules are the last one. There are bills pending in both the House and Senate on banking and IRS rules. And we'll see, that getting that accomplished is like getting an act of Congress, literally. I'm not aware of any such bill yet that addresses the transportation problem. Now, the easy solution would simply be to declassify marijuana at the federal level. That would actually solve a lot of our problems. Don't see that happening anytime real soon. So it's a challenge and probably will be for a couple of years. I'm hoping that as more states go this direction, particularly larger states like California, they have a lot of representatives in the House. Maybe the votes will sort of skew in our favor, and maybe we can get something done of that in along those lines.
All right, we're going to go back to the phones, and then I want to get Jane in here and get her perspective too. But let's hear from Tim right now in Sutton. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, and thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. The Marijuana Control Board has done a really good job getting everything together, getting all the regulations together. One thing I was curious about, as a person who's desperate to get a job in the emerging cannabis industry, the cannabis handler permit that is required to do anything in the business, when is the program going to start so I can get my permit? Is everybody in the state who wants a job going to try and get their permit all at once? What has the state done to try to help people get jobs in this business? I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thanks. That is a great question. So I'm going to take my Marijuana Control Board hat off for a moment. I'm also involved with the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association, and that organization does intend to offer training toward the marijuana handler card. So it's going to kind of be a two-part thing where you receive the training, and it's very much like the TAMS card or for alcohol.
Sure.
It's modeled
bartender's
after that.
License.
Exactly. So once you've received the requisite training on, you know, identifying, you know, knowing what's lawful, what's not, identifying a valid ID, and so forth, once you receive the training, you'll take that credential to the state, to the Marijuana Control Board, and pay, I believe it's a $50 fee, and get your marijuana handler's card. And that is a requirement for anybody who's handling marijuana, whether they're in a cultivation facility, processing, or retail. So, to answer your question, I'm virtually certain that there will be courses available, you know, training toward that marijuana handler card. Probably not by February 24th, but certainly before licenses are issued.
Okay. Well, let's get Jane in here now. She's been sitting here quietly. And I want you to tell us about how it is that you decided that you'd like to open a business. What kind of business are you interested in, and why?
Oh, thank you, Lori. Sometime last year, when after I retired, I decided with a couple of other family members that we were going to start a business, because all of our values in that business align with marijuana regulations. We are very interested in making sure that we see a safe product here. We're very interested in diminishing the black market, and I truly believe that will happen as marijuana moves into the markets in the states, in all the different states. So, and I had a personal issue with a member of my family had brain cancer, and I understand clearly that she would have had a better quality of life with marijuana products. So I'm very interested in starting a business. The business will be integrated. It will be a cultivation, a processing, and a retail. So a good example of something that we're coming up against is our business model. We're not sure if we can do that integrated model or if we have to do a retail store separately and our cultivation separately. We're just getting that information from the Muni. Actually, last night we went to a planning and zoning meeting and collected a little bit more information, but it won't be available until, I think, January. They'll make decisions around that. Is
early
that right,
January.
Bruce?
Yeah.
Right.
I did want to ask about that. I know that you had mentioned the planning and zoning meeting that was last night. What did happen there? And what about these concerns that Jane has? Do you see a time that she'll be able to have that kind of full spectrum business license available to her?
I hope so. And she and I actually share concerns on that particular matter. So, as far as the state's concerned, you can hold multiple licenses, with the exception of the testing one that we already talked about. You could have a cultivation facility and a retail facility and even a processing facility, doing extracts or baking or whatever, right next door to each other. They would have to be separated. Each one is a separate licensed premise. But that separation could just be as simple as a wall with a door through it.
And one corporation entity could own all three of those licenses?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And I think the language gets kind of jumbled with a lot of this stuff because we speak in regulatory jargon as it's emerging. And nothing wrong with the regulatory jargon that you guys have knitted up, Bruce. I think some of it's beautiful and clear in the code. But
sometimes I don't get English.
Yeah. Sometimes just watching from the outside, it can see. But, you know, this to me it's kind of an analog to like a brew pub. You know, they might be brewing on site, they might be selling it, you might be able to consume on site with other things. You know, it's both a manufacturing space, a point of sale where you could get a growler to take home with you, or and also a pub. You know, it's not unprecedented, but I think sometimes it can get really confusing because we're talking in a language that feels very unfamiliar with how most consumers and commodity consumers are kind of working in the Muni. So that's a little caveat that I would add there.
Okay. And so at the state level, it's totally possible for an individual or a group to have these multiple licenses, and they can theoretically put all these businesses they can't be on top of each other. They can't be in the same space, but they can be immediately adjacent to each other. Where it becomes problematic at the local level is the Anchorage, the proposed Anchorage zoning, would separate those. So there'd be portions of town where you can have a cultivation facility, but not a retail store, and other portions of town where you can have a retail store, but not a cultivation facility. So I think that's the stratification I referred to last night that makes it difficult for folks like Jane and others to have separate business types in the same building. So that's a problem, and that's something that the Planning and Zoning Commission is going to be looking at.
What are the concerns that create that situation where there's a desire to separate those businesses? What's been expressed that assembly members are worried about in that regard?
You know, the assembly, the 11 members of the assembly haven't yet weighed in on that particular issue. So right now it's a matter of
the state's plan.
Planning zoning staff and the Planning and Zoning Commission. You know, honestly, my perception from last night is that there's perhaps not a perfect understanding of what these various businesses are, like how they function, what they look like inside. There's a lot of misperception there. So I think that's part of it. And then the other part is just sort of an entrenched expectation of what types of businesses should or could exist in different parts of town. The irony there is that while on the one hand talking about this very rigid allocation of cultivation facilities to industrial areas and retail stores to, you know, commercial areas, in the midst of that entire discussion, they approved a daycare center in an industrial zoned area of town. So it's a contradiction.
My add-on to that is somebody that watches different I know you do too, Bruce, and you watch very closely the different ways that local governments are parsing, but different bureaucracies have different prerogatives. So planning and zoning's prerogative is to make logical, coherent decisions about how planning and zoning and platting and licensing works. And for them, I get the sense that it's much less of an issue of, you know, does somebody's business plan kind of easily and cogently move through different regulatory steps than making sure that there's a site map for a different part of town that kind of fits coherently into an overarching strategy. That might be very different from the marijuana, taxation board that's also one of the committees that's kind of looking into marijuana around the Muni, who's interested in like revenues and coherent, revenue capturing models, are different from the assembly itself, which, is usually kind of debating this issue in somewhat loftier terms of public safety and, commerce and things of that nature. So I think sometimes I pick up on a little bit of detections of when people are talking about some of these things, they note this conspiratorial or malicious intent that's permeating around different parts of government, and that maybe exists. I'm not sure, but a lot of the time, I think it's really just there's different bureaucratic silos that are handling things with a very different method.
Yeah, if I may too, I'm an architect by training, and I practiced for about 20 years, and for several years, about 10 years, in Irvine, California, which is literally a paradigm. It's a prototype planned community. But Irvine was planned 50 years ago when it was nothing but orange groves and hundreds of square miles. So they had the luxury of this very, very broad, blank palette on which to develop this planned community. Well, so Anchorage now, sort of after the fact, has been trying for 10 years plus to kind of refine their planning strategy, and it's a challenge because there's all these legacy issues. You've got this tremendous mix of building types and zones within this community. So I get that it's a challenge. So it's not a perfect or easy issue to deal with.
All right, we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll take your calls and continue our conversation about the legalization of marijuana in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The UAS School of Management offers Bachelor of Business Administration degree programs online with an emphasis in human resources and management information systems. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today, our discussion is about the legalization of marijuana. You can join us at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, or locally 550-8422. Jane, I want to return to you for a moment about trying to set up a business. What have you run into regarding the stigma of saying, hi, I'd like to rent some retail space and sell marijuana? How has that been?
It's been very difficult. When we decided, when we made this move early on and decided that we were going to do this, it was clear that we needed to get buildings so that we could make our business plan and be able to submit our application. And what we've run across are, we've been close to getting a cultivation building, but it was 488 feet from a religious place, religious community. We have approached a landlord who was willing to lease retail space, and he did a lot of research and finally came to the point where he was uncomfortable because he was afraid of what banks in the city might do if he submitted a lease that had marijuana on it. So those are the kinds of concerns and issues that we're coming up against. And as of yet, we are not we have not been successful in finding a building.
What's your level of concern about that, Bruce? That very thing that Jane's describing here, how can this whole enterprise get off the ground if landlords are hesitant to rent?
I share her concerns, and that's I expressed some of those last night. If you look at the zoning considerations, there's areas of town that are allowable under zoning, but then if you look within those areas at buildings that are suitable, and then suitable buildings that are available, and then suitable available buildings that are owned by property owners that are amenable to this kind of industry. It's a really short list. You end up, at the end of the day, there's very few properties available in Anchorage and elsewhere in other communities that where this is going to be a viable business. So it's a huge challenge.
Do you think that there may have to be some amendments that allow people to open them in other places that maybe they can't be just in certain commercial areas, that maybe there's going to have to be some amendments that kind of loosen those requirements?
I hope so. The Planning and Zoning Commission were having, they ended the evening with a discussion about that, amongst other things. And so I am hoping that at their January 4th meeting, they'll come back and they'll loosen that up and they'll allow for, a broader mix of these businesses, if only to allow this industry to be successful. Because at the end of the day, there are some really good public benefits to be gained by allowing a lawful regulated industry to get established and to eventually supplant the black market.
Let's go back to the phones. We have George Frazier on the line with us. George, you are someone who is interested in making concentrates and some of the products that a lot of people have concern about, that are worried about their safety and viability. What would you say, George, about the products that you would like to see beyond just leaf and bud for marijuana, some of the concentrates? What would you like to see happening, and how do you see your role in that?
Okay. Well, briefly, a little background on me. I'm a 25-year professional, I've made essential oils and hydrolats for over 20 years, and got interested in cannabis concentrates when I stayed in Colorado for a period of time, and I guess the biggest thing I'm hearing is people are worried about words like butane, and worried about butane being in the product and such. And if the product is handled properly, the residual butane is like no more than atmospheric levels. It's quite an issue, as to what's really in there and what people think might be in there. I'm interested in processing for.
Okay, so you're pushing back against the idea that the butane levels might be hazardous. Is there a way to deal with that, Bruce?
There absolutely is, and if I could back up a half a step, I'll just offer this. The consumption of cannabis has seen a tremendous evolution in the last 30 years, 30 or 40 years. It went from smoking of leaf to smoking of bud, and then the production and consumption of more potent and better quality bud. Europe actually was 20 years ahead of us in consuming primarily hash, which is just a derivative product of the buds. And now we've taken that a step further where folks are consuming, they're kind of leaving the organics, the leaf, out of it entirely and going to the hash and hash oil and other extracts. For folks that are listening in, I could summarize it really easy. If you take a mature cannabis flower and wash all of the sticky resinous glands off the surface of the bud, what you end up with is these oils, these essential oils that are being discussed. And those are the concentrates. Now, how you achieve that gets to the whole discussion about butane. There's different solvents that you can use to wash the buds. One home producers often use butane to wash the resins off the plant, and it's frankly a hazardous process because using butane in an uncontrolled open environment is potentially really dangerous.
Explosive.
Now in a controlled laboratory setting, what is more typical is to use a closed loop extraction system where the gases are not exposed to the environment, and that the gases could be butane or could be CO2 under high pressure, and those gases are all, they're self-contained, they're recycled, and there's building codes and fire codes that speak to the use of those things. When you get to that level, the process is virtually identical to the extraction of vanilla extract or lavender or other essential oils. So that, I think, that understanding is missing because people just aren't familiar with the processes.
All right. So there is a way to do this
Absolutely. Safely, yeah.
And we can get away from the fear of exploding houses and
yes,
things like that.
Hopefully.
That's good. We're going to go back to the phones. Steve is in Anchorage. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Glad to hear you all today. So my question has to do with the aligning of the law with existing alcohol laws, particularly as it relates to growing your own and comparing that directly to brewing your own beer. And the issue has to do with quantity. The way that we currently quantitize the volume that's available for beer is we defer to the federal law, which for an individual is 100 gallons a year. For two in a household can have 200 gallons a year. The way that we look at marijuana, on the other hand, is by discrete volume, which means that you can only have so much at any one point in time, and you can only have so much plants. But when you compare that directly to brewing beer, you can have as much supplies as you want. All they care about is that you do no more than 100 gallons a year for you. So why don't we align our marijuana laws with our brewing laws and allow people to have, say, a pound a year, as opposed to you can only have whatever volume that they've decided upon at this point in time, at any one point in time. That's not an efficient way to grow something. You have to grow a little bit all the time, as opposed to doing grow one time a year and get it done, and then you have it.
You know, I'm really glad that Steve brought that up, because that also brings to mind some questions that I had about the Raven Law that was in place from 1975 until there's still some, now there's legal gray area, and maybe not. Maybe this new law kind of renders Raven moot. But that law held that you could have up to 4 ounces in your home for personal use. And I can't remember what the plant limit was, but it was 20-something,
it's
wasn't
24,
it?
But that actually wasn't a product of Raven, but another another decision.
What happens now to that longstanding legal precedent against what we've passed recently? And how does that relate to Steve's question about volume?
Yeah. Well, so under the terms of the ballot measure, and as of February 24th of 2022, 2015, it's perfectly lawful for an adult 21 or over to have up to 6 plants in their home at any one time, 3 of them mature. So depending on how you do that.
Why that limit, though? Why 6?
You know, I can't.
That was one of the sticking points, if I remember correctly, at 12, 6, 18.
Right. Well, the 6 plant limit, I think that was really a decision arrived at by the people who drafted the ballot measure, and I wasn't involved with it at that point. They, for whatever reason, they decided that that was perhaps something that the public could get on board with. And to be honest, if you do it right, 6 plants, you know, or however you do it, if you have like two plants maturing, you know, every month, if you do it right, that's a fairly significant amount of cannabis for private consumption. Now, my understanding, so the 6 plant limit, that's pretty much a matter of law at this point. My interpretation of the ballot measure further allows you to have all of the marijuana that you harvest from those plants in your home. So whether that's 4 ounces or 6 ounces or 2 pounds, as long as it doesn't leave your home, that's lawful.
Oh, interesting.
You can give it away to a friend for no charge. You can give up to 1 ounce to a friend. I guess anybody really, for no charge. As long as no money exchanges hands, that's a totally lawful thing. But that's the personal consumption. Now, as to the parity with alcohol, it's not directly analogous, but it was sort of an acknowledgement that people should be able to, you know, grow and consume marijuana in their own homes, and in fact, they can now under present law.
One thing that I would just add, both Steve, to your point, and then just in general on this topic, is really it's. I think a lot of people have expected marijuana to be treated as analogous to alcohol in this process, and instead, what we're seeing is the regulations over alcohol are being treated as analogous to marijuana. So instead of trying to treat dosages as you know, a one shot equals X on a concentrate,
right,
or like a 6-pack is equal to 2 joints or anything like that, I think a little bit. Like a lot of those metrics don't exist. People react differently,
sure,
to different amounts of,
right,
THC in their blood. Different strains have different potencies.
Mm-hmm.
The same
thing with alcohol. I mean,
yeah,
body size, all those things come,
sure,
into play.
And a glass of wine for somebody might mean a very different psychological reaction than a shot of tequila, you know, all at once. So, but in alcohol, we've standardized that and treated it as across the board kind of being equals. And I think what we're seeing as the state and different municipalities adopt stuff is that's not working very well. Instead,
yeah,
what we're getting is let's treat the commercial industries, the licensing, the regulatory process as analogs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's that equating cannabis to alcohol is something that I've resisted in general. I mean, there's one exception to that that I could elaborate on. But in general, yeah, because of the reasons that Zach mentioned, you really can't compare them because we can regulate marijuana in a manner similar to alcohol, but we can't regulate marijuana as if it were alcohol.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to go back to the phones. Thank you, Steve, for the call. And now we're going to Marlene in Deering. Hi, Marlene.
Good morning. I just wanted to find out how come they didn't enter into their first voting for marijuana medicine. Rural Alaska. I'm from rural Alaska, and then I attempted to get marijuana medicine, but they said they can't do it in the Kotzebue Hospital or in the Alaska Native Medical Center. I only want to try to get it because of the allergies I get from certain kind of medicine, and then I think now it's worse because I have. Since 2011, 2 pins in a rod and a little V thing, and now and earlier this year an implant, and I'm getting scared to take those certain kind of medicine because I do get allergies, and then all of those stuff in my lower back with those medicine from the clinic kind of give me bad side effects.
So
I'm still healing from that lower back surgery, and why is it that rural Alaska is getting worst end of it, not on the bargain side of
sure
marijuana?
Yeah.
It's a never ending story, all right. But I'm just worried. How do you get that? Because my husband won't spend a dime on it, and I don't want to pimp him around for it. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Marlene. She presents a really good quandary. Yeah. I mean, it's a big question. We were discussing this earlier about how are you going to transport and get this into areas where it's going to have to either go by air or by federally navigable, regulated mm-hmm. waterways? What is the answer for someone like Marlene that's looking for an alternative to some pharmaceuticals?
Well, until we get the transportation problem solved, then she's probably looking at a local business, you know, local cultivator, local retail store. And I think Kotzebue is a community of a size that could support at least one or two cultivators, and I hope they will. She didn't really touch on this, but I'll just mention it. There's some anxiety, I think, statewide in certain circles at the absence of a specifically medical marijuana program or initiative or set of laws. And the ballot measure 2 specifically stated that that law would not supersede the medical marijuana laws that have been in place for a while. That said, there was never any infrastructure. So somebody who wanted cannabis to treat medical conditions really had nowhere to go to buy it. So I'm hoping that that will happen, that there will be a retail store, certainly in Kotzebue and in other communities where they can go and buy it. You know, then the question becomes, will there be strains available that meet her needs? You know, because there are differing strains, different THC content, different CBD content, and those can be beneficial for different people for different conditions. So I would hope that there will be a retail store available to her where she can just go buy a quality tested product that meets her needs.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that is curious to me to see is how hub communities will function with some of this, because Kotzebue might have a retail outlet, or you know, there might be approval at Manilik or at the hospital there in Kotzebue to be dealing with medicinal marijuana. But mm-hmm. then Marlene in Deering, how is she going to get that back to, a small community of a couple hundred on top of the Seward Peninsula? Or how does somebody, is it legal to take it in your boat back up river during the summer months? And then what happens to secondary sales in communities? I haven't seen many regulations that have sort of gotten to that are familiar with a lot of the ways that different bush economies function. And that's going to be a really curious thing. I mean, in a lot of these different small planes that are flying between hub communities and smaller communities, you don't have bag checks. You don't have, want right. offices through the troopers or through other law enforcement that are checking at each step of the way. And I'd actually be curious to hear from Jane, just somebody who's watched the medicinal marijuana throughout the state. I mean, what you've seen different people, kind of how they've developed strategies for getting medicinal products, and whether you see some change underfoot right now as things are commercializing to, kind of create a specifically medicinal, not recreational market.
Well, and I wanted to kind of add to that. Let's clarify, are you looking to open just a regular retail facility, or are you thinking along the lines of medicinal marijuana and that route? Jane, what are you hoping for?
Well, there isn't a lot of structure in the current medical marijuana rules in Alaska, of course, because you can't buy it. Mm-hmm. I happen to have a medical marijuana card, and I have to rely on in-house, and I think that's what most folks do. I don't hear anyone talking about focusing on medical marijuana. Some of the regulations won't allow us to talk about medicinal benefits of marijuana.
Sure.
So even though there are, I truly believe that. That's how we're going to go forward is talk about, we're going to be doing adult use and recreational. And I know that some folks are going to come in knowing that they can get some relief and help from some of the strains that we might provide them.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll continue our conversation on the legalization of marijuana in Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the legalization of marijuana in our state today. And we have an email question here from Jason, who is in Ketchikan and wants to know more about cultivation licenses. He's asking if we can get some comment about people seeking to cultivate marijuana plants. Will there be a limit to the number of plants that can be grown, the square footage of canopy space, or will there be a different mechanism that will be used to determine the amount of marijuana any cultivating licensee may produce?
Yeah.
Bruce, can you answer some of those questions?
Yeah, great question. And I'd offer this. There's sort of three ways of looking at that. For personal cultivation, as we already discussed, you can have up to six plants in the home, 21 and over, up to six plants in the home, three of them mature. That's personal. On the commercial side, there's two cultivation licenses defined in the statewide regs. The first one is a limited cultivator, and that one is very specifically limited to 500 square feet under cultivation. Now, that does not include ancillary spaces that might be used for drying, for curing, for prepping of product. That's just the area that's under cultivation. That's measured basically the floor space. So if you can grow five plants in that space or 20 plants or 50 plants, that's up to you. There's no limit on the number of plants or the amount that you produce from those plants. That's the limited cultivator. The standard cultivator has no limits. It could be at the statewide level. It could be 1,000 square feet. It could be 10,000 square feet. They can have 100 plants or 10,000 plants.
But are we talking only about indoor growing? What about outdoor?
We did adjust the regs at one of our meetings to allow for outdoor cultivation. That's really a function of how much land they've got. Now, there are some requirements. It does have to be fenced, and it does have to be. You still have some security requirements and so forth, and you do still have to test the product for fertilizer, for mold, and so forth. And that's going to be one of the biggest challenges, honestly, in this state, is getting a crop to maturity and not having any mold in it. That's a challenge. It's not insurmountable, but it is a challenge.
What about I thought that I had read in the regulatory structure that you can't grow it anywhere that someone can see it unless they're using binoculars.
Right. That's where the fence comes in. That's why the requirements state that if you have an outdoor cultivation, there has to be an opaque fence around the property. Now, if you're out completely off the road system or so far removed from the roads, you've got 10 acres in the middle of your 40-acre parcel, you're probably going to be okay. The idea there is that it can't be visible without binoculars, from the neighboring properties. So,
and what's the rationale behind that? Why can't we see it?
I wasn't involved with actually writing the initiative, but I think it was just sort of an acknowledgement that, we're working against 80 years of stigma. And people, just the mere sight of cannabis makes some people really uncomfortable.
Well, and wasn't that also, isn't that also partly sort of how bars have been regulated? You can't have open container laws in public.
There's that, too.
I think, a little bit of lingering stuff from just how local municipalities have regulated open containers that stuff got grafted on, is, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. I should qualify something I said earlier, because I said that the standard cultivator can have as much room and as much plants as they want. Local governments can apply more stringent requirements, and I believe Wasilla did. They limited a cultivation facility to, I think, 5,000 square feet, if I'm not mistaken. So that's one example so far that hasn't happened anywhere else in the state, other than those communities that have simply banned all things marijuana.
Talk a little more about that. What, as the chair of the Marijuana Control Board, what are you hearing from communities across the state that are sort of grappling with how do we do this and mm-hmm. respect the will of the voters? Mm-hmm. But if city leaders are squeamish about this, what are you hearing? What are the big concerns?
The resounding comment I've gotten from elected officials is that we did a really good job. They've looked at the state's marijuana regs and said, wow, okay, yeah, we can live with that. And then they're taking one step further, where they're applying some zoning considerations, perhaps a local tax, which is perfectly reasonable. So those are the positive comments that we're getting. Now, there are communities like Palmer and Ketchikan that the local government just basically said, we want nothing to do with this. We're just going to ban everything. That's their right. They can do that, and that's a conversation that they need to have with their constituents.
But they can only ban the retail and big grow things. They can't ban people that want to do this in their own homes.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. So the personal cultivation, personal possession, that is now a matter of state law, and they cannot override that.
Well, we're almost out of time, but Bruce, I want to just ask you, you're not a user, you're a pilot. Mm-hmm. Why have you invested so much of your time in this issue that really has nothing to do with you and your life?
Well, that's a fair question. Initially, it was a matter of principle because, you know, having consumed cannabis as a young man, I was familiar with it. And so I recognized that the stigma and the misinformation and the paranoia surrounding it was largely based on misinformation or just outright lies. Later, when I decided that I would pursue this as an industry, you know, as a participant, because I do intend to both grow and sell cannabis, or at least I hope to. You know, for me, it's a business decision. It's one not to be taken lightly. You know, it is an intoxicant, and it's not like we're selling potato chips or chocolate bars. I mean,
although there may be more sales of those going forward.
Well, yeah, like alcohol, it's a product that I think needs, it's for adult use at an appropriate time and place and manner. But for folks that choose to make that a part of their lifestyle, I think that they should have that right, and there should be a regulated industry that can provide them a quality product.
And when will we see actual stores? When is this going to happen? Where is the process that we will actually see a storefront in Anchorage, say?
Jane, are you having a grand opening anytime soon?
Well, it probably won't be for a year. That's my guess.
Well, so the license applications will be received no later than February 24th. The state has 90 days to turn those around, which gets us out to February 24th. But it is an agricultural product, so it has to be grown and cured and processed and so forth. So realistically, I would say July or August of next year will be the earliest that we'll see regulated stores, but we'll probably see a number of them after that.
All right. Well, thank you so much to my guests, Bruce Schulte, the Marijuana Control Board Chair, Jane Stinson, who plans to open a business when all the rules are in place, and Zachariah Hughes, our KSKA Metro reporter. And thanks to you for listening and for your calls. We'll be back next week with Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.